Well, hello once again, faithful listener, and welcome to this October edition of Small Voice. My name is Darren, and joining me in the studio are the regular team of Margaret.
Hello.
And Anne.
Hello.
We're delighted you're here to join us for another hour of Small Voice Wonderment. As ever, we won't be raising our voices, but we do hope to raise a smile or two. Small Voice, big ideas, you know the drill. This month, we review Channel 4's new drama National Treasure, starring Robbie Coltrane. Anne's guest on A Thousand Words takes us on a journey through the therapeutic power of drumming, and Margaret will be unveiling our Small Voice of the Month. We have some modern classical music from composer Riko Suzuki and friends, and as ever, we finish with our Moral Mixdown, where we take a topical issue and consider it from angles ethical, moral and spiritual, and entirely fail to have a big argument about it. It can be done, you know. Just watch us, or rather, listen. But before that, I know everyone at home will want to know that the team is well, so we have our heaven and hell health check. Anne, how's it gone?
It's been heavenly. I spent a long weekend in Manchester this month,
okay,
which is always heavenly. But it was doubly heavenly because I was there for a wedding. And it was lovely.
Grand. Let's hear it for the listeners of Manchester. Margaret, what about yourself?
Well, I had my first flight on a very small plane, which took me to the island of Tyree, I think a 19-seater, where you could actually watch what the pilot was doing as the plane moved and see it touching down on the runway on the way back. So that was quite exciting. I realised that one of the things that I've just started doing, which fills me with anticipation, in fact, for Sunday afternoon. I have joined the Falkirk Festival Chorus, which my husband has been part of for many years. But this year I joined because they're singing Messiah. And I thought, I really want to do that. And I find this music ringing round my head for days and days afterwards. I don't really know very much of it yet, but it's great. It's
really shall ask later, but clearly Messiah has to be heavenly. If Messiah's hellish, that's seriously bad news.
Oh, it's hard work, but yeah, it's going to be wonderful.
Grand. I'm kind of limbo-ish, I have to say. I'm doing a different job. I'm a teacher by trade, but I'm now doing a different job, which is still to do with education and working with teachers, but I'm no longer a classroom teacher, and I kind of said goodbye to my school officially on Friday night there. And it's a curious feeling because, you know, and well, actually everyone here around this table has been a teacher. So, you know, when people say, what do you do? My gut reaction is to say, I'm a teacher. And I'm still trying to work out what it is that I'm prepared to admit to doing that won't get people going, oh, but at least they can't now accuse me of having long holidays.
Exactly.
For our media review this month, we are taking a look at the current Channel 4 TV drama National Treasure, starring Robbie Coltrane and Julie Walters and written by Jack Thorne. Coltrane plays Paul Finchley, an ageing and much-loved comedian who finds himself accused of historic sexual offences. Examining the impact, both public and private, of such accusations against a media celebrity, the series explores issues of truth, memory, trust and family. As the investigation and criminal trial work their way towards a verdict, those closest to Paul must deal with the effects of the investigation. Memories that have become muddied in the intervening four decades are dredged, doubts flourish, loyalties are tested and truths, half-truths and lies are all exposed. So says the Channel 4 website. Here's a trailer for the series.
Ladies and gentlemen, the legend, Paul Finchley!
Mrs. Finchley?
Yes?
We're here for a word with your husband.
Word about what?
There's been an allegation of rape made against you.
Some kind of joke. You realise I'm about to be dragged through hell, don't you?
Aren't we all, Dad?
OK, let's start at the beginning.
They think I'm Jimmy Savile.
The times you came home smelling of whichever woman, and I'd understand. Well, this is not one of those times.
I'm sorry.
Seven women now have come forward.
Seven?
Dee!
I would never hurt you.
You have no reason to doubt him. It is a witch hunt.
What if he did it to me?
No.
Couldn't that be the reason that I am what I am?
I choose to believe him.
A major new drama.
I didn't do this.
National Treasure, coming soon on 4.
not just coming soon. We've had 3 episodes, 1 episode still to go. The team has been watching and catching up with it. And what have you made of it?
I was going to say I have enjoyed it, but that's not quite the right word. I think it's a fascinating series, clearly picking up on a lot of the stories that we've seen in the news over the last couple of years. Folk like Jimmy Savile or Stuart Hall or Rolf Harris, people who were in their heyday as entertainers in the 70s and who long after those years find themselves accused of historic sexual abuse. There were a number of issues raised by it, which I found really fascinating, but the one most of all that really spoke to me was the whole idea of memory and whether you can trust your memory of things that happened when you were a child. The daughter of Paul Finchley in this series is almost urged by the police to consider whether she might have been a victim of her own father's abuse, and yet she has no memory of that. But we see in the series how she's almost afraid to let herself think back now about her childhood in case something terrible comes to the surface. And I thought it raised this whole idea of what we can rely on, what do we really remember, what is suggestion, what are we suppressing. It's very difficult, both for the victim and actually I think for the accused, if this series is to be believed, to really remember what happened 40 years ago almost. I don't know what you thought, Margaret, but that was the issue that really seemed to me to come to the surface.
I think if you try and recall what you were doing 40 years ago, it can be really difficult to remember details of what was happening. I remember once being asked to take part through my work. Actually, it was a problem that somebody was talking about what had been done, and I came to the conclusion that it wasn't a 40 years ago or anything like that, but they got it wrong. Mm-hmm. I had two people both expressing something and it didn't match up. And I came to the conclusion that one of them had... She wasn't lying as such, but she had some kind of idea that was not correct, that didn't square with the other two, as it were. And it reminded me of a... sort of children make up these stories as well, but don't think they're making them up. And I think that must be terribly confusing to, you know, where you find the truth in something like that, whether it's something that you want to happen and how you get from there to, well, actually, maybe it did happen.
We're certainly not entirely clear what has happened and people's memories are hazy, but I guess in defence of the people who have been victims of these abuses, you know, in reality, never mind on TV and in fiction, you know, if someone's been raped, you know, I think they've got a right to claim to remember that.
Sure.
And similarly, you might expect that if someone has raped someone, they might have a memory of that as well. We did actually touch on this whole issue a couple of months ago when we reviewed Mark Lawson's book, The Allegations, which dealt with someone who was accused of historic sexual offences and also with someone who was accused of being a bully at work. Quite an unsuccessful kind of semi-comic novel. We didn't really care for it over much. And this, I have to say, is a much more serious and basically worthy piece of work, although there's a little part of me that senses that they can see the BAFTA nominations coming already. The episode I watched just yesterday, in fact, the opening scene had Julie Walters in real close-up, and to my mind she was looking almost like Mary, you know, the mother of Jesus, you know, almost like a scene from The Passion or something. And I think she had her hand up, and it was all done in kind of slow motion, and it looked amazing. And it was only when you eventually realised that she had a cigarette in her hand, and she was actually in a public toilet and having a fly fag. And then, of course, she put the cigarette end down the toilet and she flushed and it wouldn't go away. Mm. And I remember thinking, how powerful in terms of the memories and the things that you'd like to forget, because any smoker will tell you it's very difficult to flush those few things at me. I'm not sure that that's really talking about the worthiness of the drama, but it certainly looks amazing.
It does. It's shot beautifully and it's shot quite darkly as well. And I think you have that overwhelming sense of the whole family being under this cloud, which they can't escape from. Whether he's guilty or not, their lives are damaged forever by the accusation. And I guess we'll only find out in the final episode where the truth might lie.
It hasn't really spent much time on the victims, though, other than potentially that the daughter, we're not quite sure what's happening there, but the people who have brought up the allegations, we're not really seeing much of them at all. So it's all from the family viewpoint.
It concentrates on the accused, and they've been quite brave with that as well, because this accused man is not a very nice man. You know, we would not consider his behaviour by any means ethical, but it forces us to come back to, well, is there really then a difference between someone that we deem to be unethical and someone that society has deemed to be criminal? And yes, there is, you know, in practical terms, a massive gulf between those two things. But when they're all wrapped up in the one person, you know, there doesn't feel that much of a difference. And I guess it's very difficult for juries, when they come to consider somebody on these kind of accusations, to make that distinction between someone whose behaviour they disapprove of, someone who, in the case of this drama, has been a philanderer sort of from day one of his marriage, but someone who is a paedophile, which is a wholly different thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I find a little bit distracting, I suppose, is that I was an avid watcher of Cracker many years ago, which starred Robbie Coltrane, who had a very similar relationship with his wife in that particular programme. He, you know, a sort of same kind of guy, really. And I find that perhaps a little bit, not difficult exactly, but, you know, it just perhaps takes a little bit of the edge off it. But I think it is, it's going to be really, really interesting to see how it ends up.
Yeah, I should say National Treasure finishes on Channel 4 in the UK next week, and you can also find it on their 4OD website. As a kind of companion piece to that, there was actually a programme on the BBC at the weekend by Louis Theroux, revisiting really his documentary on Jimmy Savile, where he basically said he got it wrong, and kind of delving into the whole guilt and how could I possibly have missed, as everyone did, the behaviour of Jimmy Savile. So it's worth looking that out on iPlayer as well. If you have been watching the National Treasure Show, we would love to hear your views. You can comment on our website, smallvoice.org.uk, or tweet us at @small_voice1. We're going to have some music now, and we're delighted to be joined in the studio by Rico and Pam and Seth. So I'll say hello to you all first of all.
Hello.
And you can say hello back, which is very nice of you. Now, Rico, you are the composer, and also I think you play the piano.
Yes.
And then we have Pam on clarinet, and we have Seth on violin, and you played on the two pieces. One of them is called Woodlouse Waltz, which I think Pam played on, and I've got that right, and Autumn Wind, which Seth played on.
That's right.
So I'm afraid, Rico, because you're the composer, you're going to have to start us off and tell us a little bit about the pieces.
Yeah. I was writing pieces because I wanted to take summer course at the Royal Conservatoire.
The Conservatoire in Glasgow, yes. That's right.
So I had to submit some pieces there. Uh-huh. So I was writing some pieces.
So what we're hearing almost was like the audition pieces, although of course you would submit as manuscript, presumably. Uh-huh. Yeah. Anything you want to tell us about, say, the Woodlouse Waltz? Because I've heard it and I thought that's a waltz, so
yes,
I was doing well.
Yeah. Well, I used the basic form of waltz. I wanted to stick with really what we call waltz, really. Uh-huh. So 3-4 time, 3 beats in your bar. On the other hand, I wanted to put, of course, big stories.
Uh-huh.
That's what I like about, because I'd like to write a piece which is like a picture book. Uh-huh. So if you open it, the whole fantasy world sort of pops out, that kind of thing. So I chose very misunderstood creature, Woodlouse,
uh-huh,
and I wanted to write about it.
Okay. And so, Pam, I mean, how does it feel to get a new piece to play where you can't simply say, okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll go down to the shops and buy that piece so that I know how someone else has played it. How does it feel to get that for the first time?
It's very exciting. It's creating the sound. I mean, bringing it to life almost, although from Rico's mind out through the instrument, which is a necessary process in making music. But you've got a responsibility as the intermediary. And I loved the idea of the woodlouse and the rather strange intervals that she uses. Sometimes the tune takes an awkward turn in the middle, and I hope that's part of the story of bringing the slightly awkward little creature to life.
Now, the other piece is Autumn Wind. So yes, do you want to tell us about that one?
Autumn Wind is really... I didn't think very much, and it really came instantly to my mind. I'm a marathon runner as well, so I run a lot outside. So I feel seasons with my skin all the time. And autumn is a really lovely time, of course. But one more thing we have in Scotland is a lot of rain and strong wind in autumn.
Yes.
Well, perhaps throughout the year, but perhaps more
in Glasgow, yes.
Yeah. And I often hear the wind comes. It sort of sounds, trees are chatting and telling me when wind comes.
Okay.
And yeah, perhaps I disappear into my own world where I go running. And that's where this piece is really coming from.
And Seth, you were playing the violin on that. So how did you find the project and being involved in it?
Well, it was interesting to work with Rico on kind of bringing her vision into a kind of more fleshed out form.
Mm-hmm.
And with a piece that's already been completed in some cases hundreds of years ago,
There's not really a negotiation, is there?
Yeah, it's already like a finished thing. And working with Rico, there was very much a kind of back and forth where I would play a bit and then that would help Rico to kind of deepen her understanding of how to make it sound better, if that's an accurate thing to say, Rico.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was just a really rewarding experience for me to be part of the creative process like that.
Thank you.
Listen, thank you to all three of you, to Pam and to Seth and to you, Rico, for coming joining us. That's really been enjoyable and given us a kind of insight into this music, which people are hearing, I'm sure, is particularly those two pieces for the first time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you'll be pleased to know we'll be hearing some more of Rico's music later in the show. Time now for our 1,000 words feature. And Anne, there's almost kind of a connection here with music. I feel there should be a drum roll. as people will find out. But do tell, who's your guest this month?
Yes, it would be very apt. Because my guest this month is Jane Bentley. And Jane has been drumming for almost 25 years now. And 5 years ago, she was awarded a PhD for her research on the effects of group music making on human well-being. I think anyone that's ever sung in a choir could tell you that there's definitely a correlation. Anyway, much of Jane's current work involves developing music in health settings, working with everyone from children in hospital to adults with dementia. She began by describing the photograph that has special meaning for her.
There's about 15 or so people in the picture, all looking very happy. There's some arms in the air. There's a whole lot of drums. And I think there's a big diversity of people in there as well. There's somebody in their 20s. I can see somebody in their 70s and everybody in between, and a big mix of men and women.
It is certainly one of the most joyous pictures that has ever come before us. I recognise one of the people as you. Tell me about the others, though.
This is a picture of a drumming group, and we're just about to have our 9th birthday. We were set up for mental health and social inclusion. You know, look at this picture of people with anxiety and depression, and actually, you don't see that at all. You just see a group of happy people. And for me, that's been part of the journey that we've been on over this past 9 years of playing music together, of meeting once a week, and drumming together for people's mental health.
Now, it's not the first thing that comes to mind when you think about therapies for people with mental health problems. Mm-hmm. Tell me how you got involved and how it works.
It first happened probably about 10 years ago with a friend of mine who was a music therapist in a hospital. And at the time, her training was very much about working one-to-one with people, working very psychotherapeutically, and she kept being asked for group workshops by the other staff. And she felt she had to maintain her professional boundaries in some way, but they kept asking for group workshops. And eventually she said, no, I can't do it, but I know somebody that can. And I'd just been starting up drumming workshops at the time. And they say you always just say yes to everything and then ask questions later, a bit like this interview. I went into the hospital. And at that time, it was a very unusual thing to be turning up with a load of instruments and saying, you know, let's play drums. And it just grew from there, from one workshop. The following year, we had about 4. And there's a woman called Jeanette Allen, who's the lead occupational therapist, came along to the workshop and just got it. She just understood what was at work there. So it ended up being a partnership between her in the occupational therapy team and me as a musician that started this group, with the aim of promoting social inclusion, so that if you're in hospital, you might encounter new activities or new hobbies that you might like to do. But then if you get discharged, sometimes there's not a lot of avenues to pursue it, particularly in a way that accepts people. And so the idea was that we ran a series of workshops in the hospital, followed by a series of workshops in the community, so that when people were discharged, they could come along to that as a kind of a bridging element. And then the third step, ideally, is just doing community events with no particular mental health label attached.
How did those early groups respond when you turned up with your drums?
It's a mixture. I think there's a lovely lady who's been coming all this 9 years. She's made it part of her life. She's got this identity as a drummer now. And she says that when it was first suggested to her, she thought, are you mad? Why would I want to do drumming? Because it is unusual. And I think a lot of us still carry a little bit of anxiety about doing new things, particularly artistic and musical things. We feel it's going to be like the X Factor and we're going to be judged. But actually, drums are incredibly accessible if it's enabled in the right way. In the picture, there's a lot of hand drums. Again, rather than drums that you play with sticks, you can get two simple sounds out of it. And with that,
you can involve a group of people making successful music quite quickly. So the process of it, for me, it seems very accessible, very straightforward, quite simple. But actually, convincing people that that is the case is the hard bit, and encouraging people to come along. So quite often, the first reaction is, no, I'm not going to do that. So it takes a little bit of persuading. Nowadays, there's a few members that have come along who are now acting as peer support workers. So they will go in and from their own experience say, look, I was in the position that you were in. This is what it's done for me. So we're really always trying to keep aware of how people can access it and come into it, to make it open and to make it inclusive.
So how do you begin with somebody who puts a tentative toe through the door of one of your groups?
Even now, and even within this picture, I think there would be, there's one lady who'd probably only been for about 4 or 5 weeks. I think the lady who's been there for the whole time, she's in that picture. So sometimes just by putting it out to the whole group, you know, who's just been here recently, who's been here a long time, so that to start with, this person coming in feels like, oh, I'm not the only one and I'm not the only new one. And then it's just a very simple drum lesson of striking it in the middle of the drum, striking it on the edge of the drum. And actually the method that we use is much more about listening and relationship than it is about skill and technique. So really the most important skill that people use is listening to the rest of the group and in playing something that fits in with other people.
And does that listening and relationship that you create within the context of the drum workshop, does that spill out into lives beyond the workshop?
For me, I think that's the critical point of it. And I think that's what makes the whole thing so effective. You know, it's very communicative when we play together. So I might play something, you might play something. We'll have a little rhythm exchange. And it's like having a conversation without having to use words. So again, it's very accessible. You're not having to come to the group and tell people about your day or about how you've been. But actually, you're practicing these communicative behaviours. It's a bit like church. We have a tea break. And the coming together in the music and exchanging in the music then makes it easier to talk to each other in the tea break, because we already feel like we're part of the group and we've been accepted into it. So it's less hard to strike up a conversation to the person you've just been playing alongside or that you've echoed their beat. Some of that kind of groundwork has already been laid in the music. And then it comes out into the real world in the tea break. And then beyond the group, actually, people have developed very concrete and lasting relationships with each other, to the fact that I think people would credit other members of the group from keeping them from going back into hospital, because they've had that support that's been there for them. There's a lot less social isolation and stigma. So rather than suffering alone, they will then pick up the phone and call somebody else in the group. So it's a wonderful picture of a group of people who really are community for each other and do help each other. And so it works both ways. So a connected group makes connected music, but then the music helps people connect to each other as a group and as a community.
You know, you mentioned church in passing. It sounds to me as if the quality of community that's being generated within the group probably is more authentic than in many a church.
We work really hard at it, and particularly in acceptance. So we do have within the group people at very, very different levels of mental health and illness. We are like one big, happy, wildly dysfunctional family in that people do wind each other up, and it's natural. But we work very hard at getting over that and keep on being accepting, about keep on keeping our boundaries open and not closing off and becoming a little kind of community where we think we found the answer. You know, we keep trying to keep it open and keep it welcoming to new people and really make an effort to make sure people are included and that there's something that reaches them at their level of ability.
Several lessons there for churches to learn.
I couldn't possibly say.
but it is true that while church can do community very well, the temptation to become a closed community, not to stay open to people who are different from ourselves, is very strong within churches.
And it's the same boundary that we walk all the time. We've certainly been through periods where people have got very comfortable with each other, and then it is awkward when somebody else comes in. And of course, unspoken kind of ground rules and behaviours emerge that somebody walks into and has no idea about. it's something we work very, very hard at, not to get too cozy with each other and to constantly remember what it was like when we came into the group, in a sense, and to extend that hospitality. And I'm so proud of people in the way that they do extend themselves to others.
Great interview, Anne. I mean, she's just such a kind of cheerful, kind of positive, upbeat person, isn't she?
She is. She is full of life.
Whatever she's got, you need to bottle.
You do.
And I think you said to me earlier, before we started recording, that Jane was featured as an unsung hero on BBC their Music Day this year.
She was, and I can't imagine a more deserving person for the award. She's just doing astonishing things. And actually, we hope to get her back into the programme with her band Inva to do some music for us. So hopefully we'll get to meet her in person.
The tech team are looking forward to miking 5 or 6 drums already, I'm sure. That's going to be great. And where can people go to see a photo of the group?
Yes, you must take a look at this photo. Just looking at it will cheer you up if you're feeling a bit down. And you can find it on our website, www.smallvoice.org.uk.
Moving swiftly on, we come to our Small Voice of the Month feature, wherein we celebrate people or organisations who make a difference to the world without making too much of a song and dance about it, unless, of course, they genuinely are in the song and dance business, like Jane, in which case, yay, and on you go. So, Margaret, without getting the listener too confused, what have you got for us this month?
Well, this month's Small Voice is an organisation, and that there are a couple of songs associated with them as well, but less of that and more of where they started off, with a small shop some 30 years ago in the town of Bowness in central Scotland. It was originally inspired by the first Live Aid event and the words of Bob Geldof, well-remembered words. The intention was to make money for good causes. Now, the shop's called Branches. The organisation which runs it is the Vine Trust, so you've got Branches and the Vine. Fast forward a few years, and one of the local ministers, William McPherson, has a vision. He's in South America looking at ways of supporting Scripture Union Peru's work with street children. What about bringing a boat from Scotland to work on the Amazon? Well, if you're finding this hard to follow, you are not alone. But that is where faith comes in. And I'll let Neil Graham, who is a trustee of the Vine Trust, take up the story of the boat that became the Amazon Hope.
And as we were walking up to go back onto our motorised rickshaw to take us back to our hotel, Willie turned around to this Peruvian guy who was with us, this guy called Mickey. And he did a vision in his mind. He did this idea where he could see a Scottish fishing boat, because Scottish fishing boats were being decommissioned at the time. And he had this idea that a ship could be sent from Scotland to Peru. Now, the wee Peruvian Mickey was used to Willie going to Peru on the aeroplane. And he turned around and laughed, thinking, how on earth can you put a boat in an aeroplane? But Willie knew, and the idea had begun to grow in his mind. And it was a daft idea, but the one thing that I vividly remember was, as we got back on the aircraft, and it was the first time that I'd ever stepped out of my comfort zone. I'd never been to a developing country before. And I remember, as the aircraft took off, falling back into the chair in the plane, and the girl coming down with coffee and breathing out and just thinking, hallelujah, I can go back to the world that I'm used to. There was Willie thinking through the idea. And he turned to me and he said, do you think that people think that this is a harebrained idea? And I turned and said to him, do you know what, Willie? I know that you'll do this. I know that you can do it, because enough people will get that you can make this happen. And thankfully, that has been what's happened.
So, yes, there was a boat and a film, and the Vine Trust became more widely known when the film was shown on television. The boat became a floating clinic on the Amazon, staffed by medical and dental volunteers from overseas. That was the Amazon Hope. And then another boat on the Amazon was followed by a new country, Tanzania. And now the third boat, which is Jubilee Hope, is taking up the medical challenge of the islands of Lake Victoria. A partnership with a Tanzanian organisation has brought work parties to build homes and schools in the aftermath of the spread of HIV and AIDS. And they did similar work in Peru, in fact. And the Vine Trust has even caught the eye of royalty in the form of its patron, who is the Princess Royal. Well, it's a long way from the branches shop in Bowness, but there is still more to come. A new boat, more homes, the Vine Trust keeps on spreading and growing. So it's a great example of a small voice with a long reach.
Were you aware of the organisation, Anne? I'm not very up on these things, I confess. I must have missed the film.
Yes, I was aware of it because part of what they do is take people on what they call vision trips to developing countries. And I think you heard the kind of impact that that has on people from the interview that Margaret did. And so I think the idea, I think the Vine Trust now is trying to encourage other organisations to include these ideas of vision trips for people who might not quite have the imagination to see the worthiness of the cause and get them involved uh-huh. personally.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think perhaps from my point of view, because it began in an area that's close to where I live and was very much supported locally, it's something that I have known about for a good number of years. The film story was quite fascinating. I hadn't realised this, but various connections, which I haven't time to go into. And the film came about through a connection with Desmond Wilcox. And actually, after Desmond Wilcox had died, his film company decided to take up the story of a little boat that sailed all the way across the Atlantic and up the Amazon. And I do remember watching it on television when it came out there. But I think that just kind of caught people's imagination. It's an absolutely crazy idea, but something which does make a big, big difference. And the volunteering is something that is crucial to the whole organisation. There's not many staff, but the volunteers who get involved.
And, of course, even if people... I take it people can go along even for a short spell, like you were talking about the vision trips. Mm-hmm. The thing there is to just really shift your worldview. Yeah. I don't want to kind of have a sneak preview of what we're going to end up discussing in our moral mixdown later on in the show, but, you know, it's just that awareness of how the other half or how the other two-thirds live, which I know from... I've already mentioned my background as a teacher. I've seen... school pupils, school leaving age, go off and do charity work in Romania, and they come back with their world's been turned upside down.
Yeah,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I can exclusively reveal that Margaret has a full interview with Neil Graham and a feature on the Vine Trust, which will be available as a podcast extra via our website www.smallvoice.org.uk. And, of course, if you know someone who you think has a small voice but is making a big difference, please write in and let us know via the website mentioned it just a second ago, or, of course, Twitter, where you can follow us at @small_voice1. Margaret is waiting with bated breath to hear from you. Now, earlier in the show, we chatted to Riko Suzuki and her friends about some of Riko's classical pieces, which were recorded as audition pieces for a summer school at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland in Glasgow. We're delighted to now be able to play your recording of the piece Riko composed during the summer school itself. The piece is called Wake, and it was composed in 3.5 days. If that wasn't impressive enough, the renowned Scottish composer Sir James McMillan conducted the piece. So here's Wake, composed by Riko and played by musicians studying at the Conservatoire.
Thank you.
That was Wake, composed by Riko Suzuki. And so we come to the final part of our show, the moral mixdown, the moment where we seize the difficult topical issues of the day and we wrestle them into submission and pull out all the major philosophical and moral points. And what we're going to talk about today is such a big issue and such a difficult issue that basically, and I think I'm just going to run away, I think basically what we'll do is we will just complete an utter mutiny here. Let's talk about something else. I don't want to. It didn't happen. La, 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 la. Is there something else you'd like to talk about? Anything? No? Bake Off? Strictly? No.
What are these things?
Okay, right, okay. Conservative Home Secretary Amber Rudd. There's a word. Made a speech this week at the Conservative Party conference. The Conservative Party being the ruling party of Great Britain, or sorry, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, blah, blah, for our foreign listeners. I am just in complete denial here, but let's do this. She made a speech in which apparently she talked about British jobs for British workers, and she announced plans, or mooted plans, for UK companies to be forced to produce immigrant employee lists. Wonderful stuff. In case our listeners overseas aren't aware, Britain is in the throes of what is called Brexit, basically trying to disentangle itself from the European Union. If you're wondering what Brexit means, our Prime Minister herself has exclusively revealed that Brexit means Brexit, so that's good. We've got that sorted out. Anyway, Amber Rudd announced some pretty appalling things, I thought, being honest, yesterday. And then just today, we find a YouGov poll which seems to indicate that the British public's opinion on making companies report how many foreign workers they employ, well, 59% of British people support that and 26% oppose it. And presumably the remaining 15% were busy throwing up in a bucket somewhere. I don't know. I don't even want to talk about this. I just want to leave. I want to leave Britain. Or maybe not. Anne, can we do our quick poll here? Do we think this is a good idea, making companies report how many foreign workers they employ?
I suppose it depends on the intent behind the insistence that they do report. And the tone with which it was introduced would suggest that the intent is to name and shame those companies who employ a high proportion of immigrant workers. And on that basis, I would certainly not have
voted for
it.
I think the intent is to get rounds of applause at the Conservative Party conference. I'm getting dangerously political here. Margaret, what about you?
I'm quite intrigued because a few years back when I was filling in job applications, and in fact when I was taking on people, there was quite often a form to be filled in which asked about your gender, your ethnic origins and various other bits of information. Now, I've always hated being labelled and possibly your religion as well. I can't remember. I do not like to be labelled and put into a box as anything in particular. And that was the kind of feeling that these forms would evoke in me. Now, presumably the purpose a few years back was for organisations, and I was working for charities and applying to them, was to show, oh, we are a nice employer. We employ lots of people from all kinds of different ethnic backgrounds. I just didn't like the whole idea of adding it up. I felt whatever you're doing is not good. And perhaps this proves it in some way, that once you start taking note of these facts, the actual taking note of them, you can use that information any way you like, whether it's to say, oh, look, we employ X percent of people from various different ethnic backgrounds, or, oh, how many foreigners have we got working here? Whatever you do with it, taking the information is problematic.
I'm usually a defender of statistics, but it does seem to be a kind of naming and shaming that we're looking for. There has been a reaction on Twitter. It's funny, of course, because the problem with social media is that you tend to only really follow the people that you kind of agree with, and of course on Facebook, you tend to only be friends with people that you're friendly with. So you don't see necessarily the whole of public opinion reflected, but it was no... I wasn't surprised to see, I think it was Jay Rayner in The Guardian saying, well, you know, would you like me to wear a yellow badge? You know, because he was, you know, he had a Jewish background, and saying, you know, how, is that what we're talking about? And people are saying it's a short step, or it's a road that leads down that way. Are people being a bit extreme in making those comparisons?
Well, I think we've been taught over the last few months to avoid Nazi comparisons, if
fair point,
at all possible.
I lose the argument for mentioning.
But I do understand why someone from a Jewish background might want to put it in those terms, because the rise of Nazism began with the enforcement of categorisation of people, whether that was in terms of their sexuality or their ethnic origin or their ability, disability, it didn't matter. The first step in stigmatising and eventually attempting to eliminate certain groups of people from Germany was by categorising them, making lists. One of the things that is quite terrifying is the number of functionaries whose job was continually to make lists in the 1930s in Germany, never suspecting what those lists might lead to. And I think that's why, actually, I have found the events of the last couple of days quite chilling, not just what Amber Rudd is proposing as Home Secretary, but also the terms in which the Prime Minister addressed the Conservative Party conference. She spoke of immigration, not in terms of the facts, but in a funny sort of way, in the way that Donald Trump has been doing in the presidential race in the United States, tapped into what people feel. People with genuine grievances, I don't mean the grievances aren't genuine in themselves, people who feel that they can't get a job or they can't get a job that pays enough for the family to survive on, to take those genuine grievances and somehow ally that to immigration, what I thought was genuinely chilling, because really the facts about the impact of immigration on the economy of Britain is actually not clear. The research shows very little impact, in fact. I read one interesting statistic this week which suggests that, yes, it is possible that immigrants have had a negative impact on low-skilled wages to the tune of just under one penny an hour.
OK. Not huge.
Not huge, but... You know, that context is never given. And even that is a tentative thing. It may or may not have any impact at all because the statistics are not clear. So it was a speech based on grievance, on, I felt, the manipulation of people's genuine concerns, but without any allusion to fact, to truth.
There seems to be an ability, and this is going to sound unkind for people holding that view, but in some ways we seem to be able to hold two views at once. You know, firstly, can I point out, if genuinely 56% of the people think this is a good idea...
59.
Sorry, 59, I'm rounding down. Look, 59% of the British population are not unemployed.
No.
You know, so it's not just the people going, oh, it's because I don't have a job. But, you know, I'm thinking that maybe in some ways that the person who's saying that this is terrible, these people must not come over here, is the same person who's saying, you know, I simply must give you the number of my Polish plumber. He works so hard and takes so few breaks and he turns up on time, unlike all these British workers. You know, yeah. We almost seem able to just turn it around. And I don't know if it just comes down to the personal. If you actually know someone who is foreign, you know, over here, and you know the story behind how they got here, or for goodness sake, going back to Nazi Germany, you know, if you happen to know people who are homosexual, you know, is it just that simple that we're in communities and we're not actually making connections?
Well, I was very proud of the Scottish Conservative leader, Ruth Davidson, because she actually stood up and pointed out that immigration is good. You know, there are value judgments here that are being treated as fact. And in her opinion, and I think this would be our experience in Scotland, that actually the diversification of our society has been a strength. It's something that on the whole, the majority of Scottish people are very enthused about. You know, the idea of Scottishness as being based on ethnicity has long, 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 long gone. Anybody who wants to come and live in this country, you're Scottish, you're in, come and get your tea. that somehow seems to be missing in other parts of the United Kingdom at the moment. And as I say, I think often based on genuine worry, genuine grievance, whether that's about jobs or whether it's about the perception that public services are being overwhelmed in certain areas. But even the evidence for that is not there. But the perception is there. And I do think it behoves someone like the Prime Minister in particular to be very careful about what you say and do that backs up perception that is not based in truth, because that's not something you can then easily control in the future. Once you let these dogs loose, they are off and you don't know where they will lead. And that quite scares me.
To be fair, our producer Brian was pointing out that back in 2008, Gordon Brown for Labour did actually use the phrase British jobs for British workers.
He
and
did.
That was because the focus groups were telling them that this was a kind of hot button issue for British people. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if it's a new thing, maybe. It just seems the idea of requiring and naming and shaming just seems grateful. Just to take a slight kind of diversion, maybe, or maybe not. Margaret, do you think there's a role for... What should the churches be doing in this situation?
I think the churches do a whole lot of different things. There are churches who are, for example, hosting English classes for people coming. There are churches who are welcoming people who have left everything behind and come here. There are churches who are taking the skills and talents of people and using them. It's quite interesting to see in the Church of Scotland, for example, that many of the clergy, well, I don't know how many, but there are various people coming from other countries to take up positions here. And I think that's good. We get out there, they come in here. That's fine. We just all mix together, and I think, you know, to be aware that we are part of something bigger. The church has a long history in people going overseas and taking medical skills, taking education. There's lots of Africans who would say, "Thanks, Scotland, because you brought hospitals, you brought schools to my country." And the first generation who are educated are now running countries. Yeah. And that's because we've gone out for various different reasons, some as missionaries, other folk as economic migrants. My forebears, some of them were off to Canada, off to South Africa, mm-hmm. other parts of Africa as well, to make their fortune, to get a job. Yeah. And that's why I can't condemn anybody for doing the same.
Yeah, and I think if you're escaping bombs from Syria, it's not even making your fortune, isn't it? It's just kind of trying to find a roof that's not going to fall down in your head.
Yes, it's just preserving your family's life the best way that you can. And I think that's often forgotten in all of this discussion, that these are real people. Uh-huh. Immigrants and British-born are real people. And I don't want to overlook, I don't want to come over some kind of hyper-liberal idiot who doesn't understand what it's like for working class people. I certainly do. But I wish that we could talk about this issue based on fact and not emotion.
And it may be, I was going to say behoves, that's a good word, isn't it? Our politicians, I think you said this earlier, and to recognise that, you know, it's like listening to Donald Trump. No, for goodness sake, you have to be the adult in the room, Donald. You know, I know that people say that, I know that people think that, but you actually have to be bigger and better and more careful than that, rather than getting a group of people in the room and thinking, oh, well, you like the sound of that. Okay, yeah, okay, I know it sounds a bit crazy, but what the heck? Let's just go for it. I'll get up and I'll make a speech. And, you know, I've got used to that from Donald Trump, but Theresa May, I'm disappointed in you.
Yeah.
Around this table, I think, you know, we shall write to her in strong terms.
Well, that's actually a key point, Darren. Yeah. Let's get involved. Let's write.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you should. Don't just go, cool, outrage. Actually, get off her gentle backsides and do something about it. Well, there you go, folks. 60 minutes and not a single voice raised. Actually, you know what? I maybe did raise my voice a little bit. We hope you've enjoyed the show and we look forward to welcoming you back next month. But in the meantime, why not check out our back catalogue at smallvoice.org.uk, where you can also leave a message, or you can find us on iTunes and the TuneIn app. You can also follow us on Twitter at small_voice1. So many choices and so little time. See you soon.